This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, a unique blend of hunting, fishing, wildlife conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle. DSC's Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy, Hornady, Accurate, Deadly, Dependable, Trigicon, Brilliant Aiming Solutions, Taurus, Award-Winning Pistols and Revolvers, Mossberg, American Built, American Strong, Habit, Our Gear, Your Adventure. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to DSC's Campfires, and this happens to be our 200th episode. We've been around now for 4 years and looking forward to much more of the same in terms of maybe another 4 to 5 years at least. But today I have a truly special individual with me, Dr. Mike Arnold. Mike and I have gotten to know each other, and he's one of the people that I truly look up to and really truly admire for so many different reasons. And part of that, I think, comes from the fact that he originally hails from Texas and he's moved on here since then. But Dr. Mike Arnold does so many different things. He's a geneticist. He is very much involved in the conservation movement across the world. He's a book author. He's a writer of outdoor stories. He's a taker of big game animals. And in so saying, I have to say, Mike, welcome to the podcast, but also I'm still a little bit jealous over your brocket deer from down south of Texas a little way, but welcome to the podcast.
I recommended the counselor you needed to go see about that, Larry. You just need to remember, you know, you got to work through those issues, dude.
Well, I keep calling you about it. Hopefully that you can help me a little bit explain from a genetic standpoint why that feeling is there.
No, I think it's upbringing. You know, your parents didn't love you enough. I'm almost positive. So, no, I have the same feeling when I look at some of, every one of your darn white-tailed deer, I look at them and go, darn, you know, when do I get to run across something that looks like that?
It'll happen. I get tickled about that, too. I mean, I've been very fortunate and blessed with places I've gotten to hunt and all those kind of good things, particularly when it comes to white-tailed deer. But, you know, we live in the finest time, as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to hunting, and that includes white-tailed deer. We've got bigger racked and probably more whitetail deer now than we've had in many, many years, and maybe in, even in recorded history or even prehistory kind of thing. And the same thing can really be true now. I know that you've kind of fallen in love with Africa, and that resulted in bringing back the lions there on Katahdin 11 and all those kind of things. But, you know, I know, too, that one of your heroes was Teddy Roosevelt and, you know, guys of that era. And you know, you think about when they went to Africa, they went by a boat. It took days. And then they had to get on a train. And then they would finally get to a point to where they could jump off. And, you know, their safaris were, oh, my gosh, you know, 60, 90 days. And I think even a lot longer sometimes. And yet we can get on an airplane, fly there in a day for the most part. And within 2 to 3 days of leaving home, we can be on truly in safari on a camp somewhere.
Absolutely. It's, and you know, you think about it and it's just, it takes you longer, and you've done this more than I have, but I mean a lot more than I have. It takes us longer, doesn't it, to get into say Western North America or up into British Columbia or someplace like that a lot of times than it does to get to somewhere in Europe or Mexico or Africa on one of our safaris. And I'm, you know, now I still love, you know, those trips into the Northwest and the West U.S. and into Canada, but still, you're exactly right. You know, I bet they got a little tired of those travel times, but you know, they were used to it, I guess, and that was just the norm. But yeah, driving, we couldn't afford to drive around, could we, right now, very long, and on safaris, because it cost us too much money to have to drive somewhere as opposed to fly.
Exactly, and I think everything, you know, is relative. They were probably thrilled that they had faster boats as compared to the sail ships years ago kind of thing. And then yep. the trains that they were on were coal or steam instead of, you know, maybe having to go on horseback or something. So I guess everything is relative when you get right down to it. But you've just gotten back, and this is, I want to visit with you a little bit about your last trip. But I was somewhere, I think, actually, I was on a fishing trip with Jim Zumbo and Rick Lambert in Oklahoma, and I kept getting these photographs by text, which absolutely truly amazes me, of you with animals in Africa. And I'm going, and then I noticed, too, that a couple of them were every bit as big, and at least one that was a whole lot bigger than anything that I've shot in that same species. And I've hunted them a bunch.
Yeah, so for your listeners, they need to know that Larry is nice and Mike is mean. You know, that's the bottom line, and they probably figure that out anyway. No. But yes, we'll visit that one in just a minute. But we started out the main emphasis of the trip. It was Francis and I, my wife and I both went. Francis is a camera person and videographer, again, bless her heart. She's not a hunter, but she sure loves Africa. And the main emphasis of the trip was conservation. Yes. Through hunting. And that was what we were gathering information for. There's three sports field articles, for example, coming out of our Mozambique time. Mozambique and South Africa time.
Right.
That one is on the cheetah lion reintroduction. One is on pangolin reintroduction, rewilding. So the little scaly anteater into Mozambique and Katahdin 11. And then the third one's on rhino work that we did in South Africa in the Kalahari area. So, and I was doing, I was gathering information for articles, but I was also gathering information for another book that I'm working on currently. Yes. About conservation through hunting, but worldwide. But we also did some hunting. You know, I got a bush pig finally. I got a bush pig in Katahdin 11 and a Liechtenstein heart of beast, one of those funky looking things. Yes. Up there that you can only get there. And you've been to Zambia, right?
No, but I know the one you're talking about. I've hunted them elsewhere. Yeah. Farther north.
You can get it in Zambia or you can get it there. And for some reason, I thought you'd been to Zambia. So there are just a couple of places. Now, they're all over the place at Katahdin 11. As Mark Haldane who runs that place said to me, "You don't get a Liechtenstein Hartebeest, you're blind or real picky." And I said, "Yes, sir." So they've got tons of them and real nice ones, and I did get a nice one. And then we came back down to South Africa, and we hunted in the Eastern Cape, and then gathered information for articles there and that sort of thing. So that gets me to the point where I wrote a silly article, and Larry has seen it, and so is my brother, and it's called "Larger Than My Brothers" or "Larry Washington's." And now there's a subtitle to that racy sounding title, which is that a steam bock at last, and that's what I think you were referring to. That I did finally shoot a steam bock out of all the Tiny Ten. That's the one that I did not have.
I mean,
Larry and my brother gave me heck over, you know, kidding in a nice way about the fact that everybody, even Stevie Wonder, had a steam bock and I did not, and so what was wrong with me, kind of thing. So I finally did get one, and that was in the Eastern Cape area in the Cat River Conservancy.
That is such a fantastic area. The Eastern Cape is, and I've actually even been in the Eastern Cape when it was really, really cold. I remember a time when I was there on a hillside hunting the mountain reed buck, and we were hunting in snow, and it was snowing the time we were there. So I came back and I told people about it, and if I had not had photographs, and then this was go back to the time when we were just starting to do some video in hunting in Africa, and had not had the video, I think the people that I know, particularly here in Texas, would just kind of looked at me when I said that. I said, "Oh, no, wait a minute, I've got proof kind of thing." But it can be really cool. That is such a beautiful country in a lot of different ways, is it not?
It really is. The Cat River Conservancy is down, you probably know the Cat River area, but it's down in the, well, what you would call the lowlands of the Eastern Cape.
Yes, sir.
And we got steambuck, and I got a common eland. It's all low fence. Both properties that we hunted were, you know, free range animals, and it's not fenced in at all, which is what I wanted to go do. So it's in the lowlands. It rained on us a little bit. It was a little bit chilly. But then we went up to the Stormberg area, which above tree line, which is what you're talking about.
Yes.
And Frances's quote the whole time is, looking at me, she kept saying, "I just want my feet to be warm." You know, I mean, it was cold. There was a 40-mile-an-hour wind up on top. It really reminded me of the western U.S. Looked like Wyoming foothills of the Rockies kind of area. Beautiful, gorgeous, gorgeous area. But jiminy crickets, it was cold. It really was. And I shot a, give you an idea of the wind, I shot a spring buck up there. I just finished an article and turned that one in. Shot a spring buck that, I mean, they were just as flighty as heck.
Yes.
I mean, just like antelope. It's like pronghorn, I mean. And we spent our we had our iPhones, which is not a good idea, and we looked at how far we went. The stalk, which was mostly on hands and knees, went over 4.5 miles.
Oh, my gracious.
And we kept bumping them. And finally, we got within 318 yards, is what our rangefinder said, and I took the shot. The bullet drifted. I guessed, Larry. I mean, you know, I knew what the trajectory was going to be dropping. But I guessed where because of the 40-mile-an-hour wind at 318 yards, the bullet drifted over 10 inches. We did a video later of where the entry wound was and the exit. It drifted 10 inches. That was a 200-grain, 300 Winchester Magnum from Hornady. And the darn thing drifted that far in that wind. And so it was windy. I mean, I loved it.
Oh, yeah.
West Texas.
Well, you mentioned that. I've hunted Val Ray Buck kind of in some of those areas up there. And it reminded me a lot of the higher country of Wyoming, including the wind. And, I mean, it was mostly just grassy open hills. We were, you know, to me, it kind of looked like above timberline kind of thing. And I shot one. The one that I shot there, I shot with a 375 Ruger. And Same thing, even with the heavy bullet that I was using, and I think it was a 300 grain DGX, because that's what I carried with me for all the other stuff that I was doing while we were there. And even it drifted, you know, at almost 300 yards, probably about 6-8 inches. And so it's amazing what the wind can do to bullets sometimes.
It's look, you know, the Springbok dropped. Okay, all four right. legs lifted off the ground. It dropped. It didn't twitch. And Dave, my PH, slapped me on the back. What a great shot! And I said, "Well, Dave, okay, let's review." Now I knew, you know, from practicing where the bullet drop should be.
Yes.
But I held over its hip. Because it was, you know, quartering away. And,
right.
And I said to him, I said, look, you know, I mean, there's some luck in here. And I don't know. I know there's some snipers out there who would have read the wind just fine. But I'm, you know, I'm not there. So anyway, I was very, very happy that, and it was a beautiful animal. I was very pleased with it. But yeah, it's, I told him I like to be within 50 yards, no wind.
You're talking about me here as well, too. let's talk a little bit about your purpose in going. I know there were actually many purposes when you get right down to it, but the new book that you're working on, how did all this play into that book and the production of that book is coming in the future, I'm assuming now?
Yeah, so it's a good question, and I have two more places that I need to get to, and if your listeners are out there and they have suggestions, please come to me. But actually, I have one covered, and that is Central Asia. I need to get to, and that's Pakistan. We had to delay that one because they're having elections in October. We had our whole trip set up, but it's a little bit, there's a little bit of disturbance there right now.
Yes,
so
sir.
They suggested we wait until next May. But Europe, I want to go to Europe as well and look at their models. But what we were doing in Africa this time was gathering information on models of conservation through hunting that we had not seen before. So, for example, the rhino work in the Kalahari of South Africa. So we worked with black and white rhinos, helped in the darting, and we didn't dart, but I mean, helped right. in the collection of samples, medical treatment, that sort of thing of these animals that are being conserved there. The money that is used, that is the basis of that conservation comes through hunting on this massive property out there that's, you know, like 260,000 acres.
Yes.
And so all of the security, and the security costs them about $80,000 a month, I think it
oh
is.
My goodness,
and so
yes.
to just keep these animals safe from the syndicates, the poaching syndicates. And so working with them and gathering information and talking to them and understanding, you know, what hunters are doing to try to keep an incredibly endangered set of couple of species, the white and the black rhino, from disappearing off the face of the earth, and keep them in a natural setting, as natural as possible, so that people can see them and people can view them. However, they need to be hunted. They need to be hunted for income, but they also need to be hunted for population control and genetic diversity. You and I have talked about this before.
Yes, right.
You do not want to build up inbred and, you know, populations. And so you have one of two ways of keeping that from happening. You export, you know, brothers mm-hmm. and sisters or cousins or whatever out of properties, or you hunt them. And hunting them obviously then allows you to purchase more rhinos in this case that bring in additional diversity. So that's what we were doing. We really, our trip, it was, like I say, it was a little over 3 weeks in total. It was really focused on trying to understand what hunters are doing for conservation in this case. And Larry, it's just amazing what hunters do. And we ought to be really proud of that, both here in North America. It's not just Africa. Here in North America, in Europe, in Central Asia, in Africa, you know, hunters are really the backbone of conservation efforts in so many areas that work. I should say, or effective conservation.
You're right. I've been involved in with Dallas Safari Club, with DSC, and also the DSC Foundation. And we finally have the DSC Foundation where it's under DSC, but also a standalone group. And through DSC Foundation, we have funded all kinds of different research, including a lot of the stuff that's gone on with Mark Haldane, who's been a recipient of money from DSC and DSC Foundation for a long time. As are some of these other projects. And all that money, quite frankly, comes from money that we accumulate through auctions and through donations and things of that nature. But interestingly, when you start asking those people who are donating, who are buying, it is hunters. It is hunting that is supporting all this. And you mentioned a while ago, it's costing them how much per month to just protect these animals that they have? That's not even including all the other things that go along with it in terms of moving animals and bringing animals in. It's a tremendous amount of money, is it not?
It is. I mean, we're talking millions. Well, in terms of the rhinos, just the rhinos, it's millions of dollars. It really is millions of dollars each year. And I'm actually have a conversation that I'm a Zoom call to a guy in England who is actually in charge of the three largest white rhino herds in South Africa.
Really?
After you and I finish up, I'm gonna get in contact with him, and he wants to talk to me. He's not a scientist. He's actually someone who has a military background, this sort of thing. And so we're going to chat about, you know, how could I contribute to try to affect in a good way the South African government, just to say, okay, think about it scientifically. Think about it from a conservation standpoint. You know, think about the harvest of horns and cutting down on the impetus and the catalyst for poaching teams. If you actually go out there and harvest horns, like you said that you were going to do, the South African government, if you allow the property owners to do that, and they can recoup some of their costs and still keep the hunting going as well with the old bulls that need to be taken out of the population, then you're allowing them to be economically viable, and you're keeping these two species around, and you're reducing the need for wealth or the impetus, economic benefit to poachers. If you flood the market with a bunch of horns, it's going to work. And so it's those sorts of things that it's millions and millions of dollars, regardless of whether or not they allow the property owners to do that. But if they don't allow them to do it, there are two properties that are about to shut down, and they probably have 3,000 or 4,000 white rhinos each.
Oh my goodness.
So what's happening to those animals? Well, they're going to be put down. There's no recourse. If you're bankrupt, you know, you're not going to drop the fences.
No.
The animals are going to have to be put down. And so that's the kind of thing that we want to get across to those who are conservationists or preservationists, is that you're being short-sighted. You're saying the animals shouldn't be touched, but you don't understand that the taking of a single bull black rhino funds the whole operation for 12 months. And, you know, or really helps towards that. So the funding of that operation and the preservation of that species. Now, what do you want to see done? You know, do you want to lose it, or do you want to help with this process and allow, first of all, the darn thing's going to die, or it's going to be killing other bulls and you're finally going to have to put it down,
right?
Because it's just gotten to that stage. So...
Gosh almighty. You think about that. If people just used a little bit of common sense and we had true conservationists, which to me means wise use or wise management thereof instead of preservationist. Yep. And what I'm reading into this, that the preservationists are really the ones who are killing, when you get right down to it, that species.
It is true, Larry. Unfortunately, preservation, where what they're talking about is no intervention whatsoever, no control, no whatever, and no hunting in a lot of cases, what they're really doing is leading to mismanagement rather than what you do all the time for landowners, which is wise management and using, like you said, common sense, but it's based on your scientific understanding as well, right? I mean, and your right. knowledge, your broad knowledge base. I mean, let's just put it this way. None of your property owners, unfortunately, I shouldn't say this because I could make a lot of money, would want to bring Mike Arnold in. They're going to want to bring Larry Wiseman in and, you know, to do their properties, because if they bring me in, they're probably going to end up with a lot of prickly pear and that's it. You know,
I'm not. Well, that's not all bad either, Tom.
So, you know, so it's, you want to draw from all of those expertises and inform. So I'm hoping maybe, you know, it would be lovely to be able to be, that's the reason for these books, Larry, that I'm writing. And a lot of the articles is to try to inform folks, hey, this is what's going on. Because even hunters, like you said, hunters don't even know.
No.
Right?
You're right.
We're not in the know in a lot of these cases.
Exactly. To me, there are so many different ways that they could work with the Rhino program to perpetuate that species and to continually make sure that we have them in the future. As I recall, the Rhino horn pretty much continues growing throughout its life, doesn't it?
That is correct. Yeah. So, and you can harvest.
Yes.
You can just harvest the horns and they will grow back. For example, one of the bulls that we, I sent you that photo where
right,
I
exactly.
had a hold of the rhino horn in an ear because someone yelled out, grab the horn in the ear and like an idiot. I you'd think at 65 years old, I would have learned not to have just listened to people like that.
Yeah, but I'd have been disappointed if you hadn't done it.
And so, but that particular rhino had killed two other, he was fully mature bull, an older bull, and he'd killed two younger bulls. And so what they did was sawed off the tip of his
yes.
horn while we had him down, had him anesthetized. They sawed off the very tip of it. And I said to him, how long will it be before it grows back? And they said, oh, it'll grow back in another probably 18 months or something. He'll have the tip back.
Oh, my goodness.
So they actually grow a bit faster. I cannot remember right now. You may know. One of the species, black or white, grows faster. I think it's black.
I think so, too.
You just have more whites around is why they're poached so much more.
Right.
Of course, they get larger as well. I mean, larger-bodied animals. But yes, anyway, the horns grow. If you saw them off, they grow back. They're a fingernail, basically, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, a large fingernail. But, I mean, that's the same material.
Well, that to me, you know, if you took a common sense approach, if you had a herd, if there was a legal market for rhino horn, that would pretty much to me eliminate some of the serious poaching problems that we have, particularly if there is a certified animal that you take it from, that it has to be, you know, part of a program kind of thing. But that to me would be an ideal way to make sure that we have rhinos well in the future.
Well, and once again, the South African government stepped, for example, and I don't mean to be picking on them,
no.
but they said they were going to allow that. And that's why people invested millions into bringing these animals into their
yes.
properties. And then they stepped away from it because of political pressure from guess who, you know, places like the U.S. and Europe in particular, and, oh, you shouldn't be, you know, touching the animals. They should never be darted. They should never be X, Y, or Z. And And now they're going to be paying the price. The animals are paying
the price. The animals are paying the price. Yes, sir. My gracious. So what, beyond the rhino project, we talked a little bit about the hunting that you got to do. What were some of the other things that you were involved in while you were there? I know you were gathering all kinds of material for the new book.
Well, I was. I mean, once again, Diana Rupp asked me to do another update on the lions and good. Cheetahs. I was just going to do it on the cheetah reintroduction in Katata 11, and she said, "Do you mind doing it on lions?" And she's probably like you. She comes up with really cool names for articles and stuff. She always replaces the names of my articles. I'm not sure why. That's pretty bad, actually, that I can't come up with good names. But anyway, she came up with the Cats of Katata 11, and she said, "Just do the lions and cheetahs." So we actually booked some time in helicopters and in ground vehicles while we were at Katata 11 to go out and view cheetahs and on the ground and from the air, and then the lions that were collared. I got to tell you an anecdote. It was so hilarious. So we're in the four-wheel drive, and we're going out to see this big male cheetah. And they have located it. They know where he is, blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, we get there and we see him. And he's, trying to hide underneath a palmetto. And Francis right. and I are both there. And the scientist who's working on him, Tamar, she said, "Look, do you want to get down off of the truck and walk up there and, get a little bit closer to him?" But Francis and I look at one another and go, "We're not sure this is a joke or she's just mad at us about something." But anyway, so we get down off the deal. As we're going past the window with the PH who's driving the Land Cruiser, he looks at us and goes, "Godspeed."
And it would take that.
"I can't outrun you, huh?" No. But anyway, so we did get to get up closer to it, but it was wonderful. The projects there, these reintroductions, we're talking about hunter-funded things. The Cabela Family Foundation, and I know we just lost Mary recently.
I know, so sad.
It broke my heart to hear that it happened, and my heart goes out to Dan and the rest of the family, all of them. I hated to hear that Mary was gone. She was a sweetie and one of my friends. I just loved her to death.
Yes, sir.
And, but anyway, the Cabela Family Foundation. And they won't tell me how much, but I know they're spending millions on these reintroductions.
Yes,
and
sir.
They are a hunter-funded foundation. They are committed to seeing this kind of work where the cheetahs are never going to be hunted, Larry.
Right.
And it's like the pangolin work, that they're doing. The scaly anteaters aren't being rewilded in there. So for hunters to take, it's nothing like that. $100, hunters are passionate about seeing these ecosystems put back together. I'm just so proud of us. I really am.
I am too. I am too. And you mentioned the pangolin. I've seen cheetahs on Marina Lambrick's place there in Namibia, and they were radio collared, and we played around with that a little bit while I was there. But the pangolin we found on a property somewhere close to Windhoek, as I recall. And absolutely an amazing animal in so many different ways. I mean, you talk about looking prehistoric. They truly do.
They really do. I mean, once again, they have the adaptations that our armadillos do.
Right.
Unfortunately for them, over the last, in a 10-year period, they lost something like 10 to 15 million of them out of nature. And the reason, and because they're spread all the way from Africa to Asia. And
right.
So there's a bunch of different types, 7 or 8 species, something right. like that. But, you know, once again, they're used for traditional medicine. The scales are supposed to be effective for various things, which doesn't make any sense. Once again, the scales are basically keratin. I mean, they're fingernails. Right, you know, it's all mythology, but they're also used for jewelry and all this sort of stuff. And they're eaten. You know, the meat is considered, the flesh is considered a real delicacy by a lot of folks. And so... the fact that, and that's being just funded, just to tell you, and it's in the article I wrote, but that's just being funded right straight out of the pocketbooks of Mark and Lorette Haldane. I mean, they just decided they wanted to do this, and they're going to do fundraising. And I hope that they'll find sponsors, because these little guys and gals are, need to be protected and put back into places like Katana 11. So.
Oh my goodness. Lots of interesting things going on there. And again, it comes right back down to the fact that hunters are paying for all this conservation, not just for the animals that we're interested in hunting.
Like I say, I'm proud of us.
Oh my gosh. We ought to be absolutely, truly proud. I know that, you know, here in the U.S., and it's basically the same way. It is the same way. It's hunters paying for conservation. It's not just paying for conservation of game animals, but all the other animals that are out there as well, too. And particularly in terms, a lot of times, in improving and maintaining the habitat such that it is. And so, hunters, if you're out there listening, I know there's a few of us out there, you know, tell your story. Be proud. If you have an opportunity to explain why hunting is important to not only here in the U.S., but the animals we just talked about in Africa, by all means, please spread the word. I've had the opportunity to visit with some people through some of the things we do there in Round Top, Texas, where ladies know that I do some hunting because of the heads that we have on some of the walls. And they, you know, I can see, and I'll go over and visit with them, and they said, you know, isn't that species just about gone? And I go, no, ma'am, it's here because of hunting. And get to explain to them why hunting is important and how hunting plays in the conservation of not only the animals that we hunt, but, you know, the non-game species as well, too. And so if you get the opportunity, by all means, please tell people. And thank you for doing what you're doing with the books. My gosh, I've run into people in airports and a bunch of other places where people, I look over and say, what book is that? And I can say, it's Bringing Back the Lions. And I go, oh, man, I know that guy.
Don't read that book.
No, by all means, read that book and then pass it on to somebody else. Go buy several copies to give to your friends.
Well, you know, we met some non-hunters actually when we were in Johannesburg, and at the guest house there. They're real sweet at the guest house. They're selling copies, and cool. There was a couple of copies left, and this couple, there was one sitting on the table, and they were asking, yeah, what's this book about? And I said, Francis, I laughed, and we told them a little bit about it, and they went and bought a copy. And the guys, we started talking, and he said, you know, I'm really interested. He said, I'm not a hunter.
Really?
And he said, but a lot of the folks here in this guest house are, and I guess you are. And I said, yeah, I'm a hunter. And so he said, I want to read this book. I want to read about, you know, what you've just talked to me about. And I said, well, I hope it's effective, and I hope you enjoy it more than anything else. But I hope also it, you know, it talks to you about, you know, why we think that hunting is so effective in conservation and community development. So that was encouraging as well. It's just to see some non-hunters reading it is fantastic to me.
I totally agree. And again, like I said, I think the smart thing for us to do is where we can with that book is to purchase it. And after you've read it, pass it on to somebody, but even better, keep it and buy a few other copies to give friends that may be riding the fence, or, you know, you visited a little bit about conservation in the past, because the message that you provide in there is just absolutely fantastic.
Well, I think everybody ought to buy at least 1,000 copies.
I do too.
Well, let me guess. My grandchild needs some toys. So anyway, no, I really do hope that it has a good effect. And we've been encouraged. The sales have been very good. But, I mean, I'm just encouraged that it's getting into folks' hands, whether they're hunters or not hunters.
Absolutely. And I'm thrilled for those who are reading it who are not hunters. Now, you've got other books coming out. And I want to talk about those a little bit in the future here. We'll try to get together. I know that you've got a meeting coming up with a gentleman to talk about rhinos in just a little bit. But you mentioned Europe, and you mentioned if anybody has suggestions, I would like to suggest somebody to you. And that's if you're anything in Europe that we've hunted with numerous times, it's Scandinavian Pro Hunters. It's Stefan and Sophia Bengston, and both of them are wildlife biologists. Both of them are extremely knowledgeable as far as all the hunting things that go on in Europe and across the span of Europe, actually. And I can highly recommend. They're very easy to visit with, fun to be around, and have some great properties that they have access to. So, and they're very attuned to what's going on as far as hunting is concerned throughout Europe and throughout the world, too. They hunt Africa a little bit and also here in North America, but they really know what's happening over in Europe. So those would be some really good contacts, and hopefully I can get them onto the podcast here for too long as well, too.
Oh, that's fantastic. And, you know, people have asked me, why do you, you know, express things that you don't know? And I said, I don't know if you've ever met a professor before, but most professors know very little, and we should just admit that. And every time I teach a course, I realize when the kids raise their hands and I'm supposed to know everything, and they say, what about this? And I look at them and I go, you know, I have no idea, but I'll look it up for you. So I appreciate that, Larry. That's why I threw it out there, is because, you know, I know what I don't know on this, and I'm really looking for those contacts, but I will definitely reach out to them. Now, I do have a sensitive question, though, for you. Should I mention your name?
You know what? Actually, they're dear friends, among other things, as well, too. And I've worked with them a little bit on some of their properties and that kind of thing, too. And so, absolutely, please mention my name, because I think the absolute world of both of them, because, again, they're outstanding wildlife biologists on top of everything else, and very much involved in the hunting world there. And they hunt for the right reasons, as far as I'm concerned. And they do a lot of things for the habitat and the non-game species that are available or that are there on those properties as well, too. So great operations, great people, and a lot of fun to be around on top of everything else. Mike, I know you've got to go here in just a little bit. Please tell everybody how to get in touch with you, how to get the your website, which is probably the easiest and the best way to learn more about the books. And I'm sure you'll be making announcements there. And then about time you get back from your next trip, or before you leave, I want to get you right back here again around the campfire as well, too.
Oh, you're very kind, Larry. So, yes, if people want to reach out to me, my email is mike@mikearnoldoutdoors.com, and my website is just mikearnoldoutdoors.com. And they can purchase a book there if they want to, and that'll come to them signed. If they buy it through Amazon, I don't ever see those, and so those won't be signed. I'll also mention that Larry is connected with Sporting Classics. Sporting Classics bookstore has copies of it, same price, and those are signed. So I just wanted to mention that, because I know they're doing, you know, you do work with them and absolutely, you write for them and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Great publication, as Sports of Field is, too. Diana Rep's been a friend for many, many years, and I've been fortunate to have an article too there occasionally as well. So, Mike, thank you so very much. Again, I could not have thought of anybody that I would have wanted to have on the program for the 200th episode. So I am so truly honored that you could be here with us today, and really look forward to the next time we get together and getting you back here to Texas on a deer hunt or something, so we can sit around the campfire and tell a few stories that we probably shouldn't be telling on the podcast kind of thing. So
I would love it, Larry. Well, you have a good rest of the day.
And you too, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, please join us right back here next week for the 201st episode of DSC's Campfires. Thank you so very much for being with us.
DSC's Campfires has also been brought to you by the Crown Bar in La Grange in Round Top, Texas, Texas Wildlife Association, Double Nickel Taxidermy, H3 Whitetail Solutions, and Burnham Brothers Game Calls.